content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we will pick up where we left off in the article Exploring Hemingway's Pamplona by Tony Perrottet. An offbeat journey to the legendary Spanish festival, 100 years after the life-changing trip that inspired The Sun Also Rises. Mr. Perrottet was describing his day, and so he's just gone to a party, and then now he's moving on. They've already done the running of the bulls in the morning, and now he's moving on to a ritual at 1 p.m. While the Encierro is Pamplona's most publicized event, devotees cherish a more exclusive ritual held every day at 1 p.m., the apartado, or separation, of the six toros bravos in the special pen attached to the stadium. Again, Monning, who leads a bullfighting fan club in New York, led me through an anonymous-looking doorway into a self-contained world. An elegantly coiffed crowd of Spanish artists, politicians, bull breeders, and lifelong aficionados gathered on two tiers overlooking the corral while slipping Andalusian Fino, a light sherry, as the three matadors were assigned their bulls for the evening by drawing lots from the mare's hat. True diehards in the audience could also snack on criadillas, bull's testicles. I pass, but many Pamplona restaurants offer bull on the menu, including Estofado del Toro, a rich stew that is surprisingly tender and tasty. From there, we dash to the annual luncheon hosted by the Club Torino de Pamplona, which was founded in the late 1940s and has its headquarters near the stadium. Some 100 local guests sat at trestle tables laid end-to-end in a leafy park and were served mountainous platters of grilled meat, fish stews, and salads. I found myself next to a doctor who worked at the emergency room in the bullfighting stadium. "It's one of the best places in Spain to have an accident," he boasted. "I have a full operating theater." News of social events were passed around by word of mouth. The next afternoon, Monning got wind of a reception at a private bullfighting museum. It was opened in 1984 by a local aficionado named Marcelino Jimenez Eliza Garay in his own apartment and lovingly preserved after his death in 2006 by his wife, Mari. This time we climbed a series of creaking wooden stairs to find an Aladdin's cave of artifacts. Every inch of wall space was covered with vintage posters, bejeweled matador outfits, antique photographs, one of Antonio Ordonez posing with the bewhiskered Hemingway in 1959, and a handmade replica of an 18th-century bull ring, complete with hundreds of detailed human figures. The wine was flowing. A professional cortador slicer was cutting ruby-red shreds from a side of ham, and a dozen white-clad tenors, among them members of bullfighter Andres Roca Rey's Cuadrilla support team, burst into a spontaneous rendition of the so-called Astrain Waltz, a refrain heavy with civic pride. Because the festivities have arrived in this glorious city, which is something like no other in the world, row, row. At 6:30, Pamploneses converge on the central and most controversial ritual of the festival, the corridas, or races, as bullfights are known in Spanish. Some scholars speculate that bullfighting's origins were in the Roman era or the Middle Ages, but the corrida began to take its modern form in the 1700s, when Spanish cattle ranchers vied to breed the most powerful and handsome bulls, like thoroughbred horses. Towns all over Spain developed festival rites that included different versions of the bull runs and often ended with men fighting the finest animals, with matadors in ornate, tightly fitting outfits taking to plazas on horseback and on foot. These diverse traditions were codified into a ritual that has changed little in the centuries since. Today, the evening starts with the procession, when three bullfighters, their teams, and stadium workers enter the ring and salute the president, who runs the event. The matadors each fight two bulls in contests that last for roughly 20 minutes and end with the animal's death. The only way for a bull to survive is if the crowd demands that it is too beautiful and should become a stud, an extremely rare occurrence. In Pamplona, the corridas only occur during San Fermín or held in the majestic Plaza del Toros. The approaching road to the stadium was renamed the Paseo de Hemingway in 1967, and a bronze statue was erected of him at the arena's entrance in 1968, glowering at visitors as he once did at everyone who questioned the value of bullfights. Tastes, of course, have changed. In recent years, animal rights activists in Europe and the United States have called for an end for the contests. There were critics even from even within Spain. And bullfights were banned for a time in Catalonia. They have also been banned in much of Latin America. Many foreign attendees at San Fermín have no stomach for the spectacle and spend their early evenings carousing in local bars instead. Hemingway tried to explain to critics that bullfighting was not a sport. It was a tragedy, and his obsession with bullfights had a philosophical side. He was both fascinated and horrified by the senseless, random violence of modern life. Having nearly been killed by an artillery shell at age 18 while volunteering as a Red Cross ambulance driver on the Italian front in World War I. In bullfighting, Hemingway discovered violence that was ritualized and controlled, and in which death was openly confronted. As Reynolds puts it, for Hemingway, it was like watching the war from a ringside seat. Even in 1925, not everyone shared Hemingway's passion for bullfighting. Richardson would turn her eyes away and embroider during the goriest parts, while Loeb admitted he was unimpressed, saying, "We all have to die, but I don't like to be reminded of it more than twice a day." Whatever your opinion, the evening's extravagant pageantry makes it a living relic from the time of Cervantes and Velázquez. The vast open-air arena lit by golden sun and packed with 19,500 people in white outfits and red scarves, roaring and singing. Seats are reserved year to year by the same families, and everyone knows their neighbors and brings wine and delicacies like tortilla sandwiches to share. The stadium seats are divided into sol and sombra, sun and shade, with the cheap upper tiers of the sun-blasted side taken up by social clubs, whose bands play cacophonous music with tubas, trumpets, and drums. These range from traditional romantic tearjerkers to outbursts of jingle bells, and even Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline. The gleeful air of anarchy in Pamplona is very different from bullfights in Madrid and Seville, where the ambiance is so reverent that the expression goes, "You can hear the bull breathe." After a few days of revelry, going to sleep at 3 a.m., waking up at 6 a.m., bull runs, lunches, aperitivos, dances, my constitution was reeling. 100 years ago, the same regime made the expat's behavior go from bad to worst. The dancing kept up, the drinking kept up, the noise went on. Hemingway wrote in The Sun Also Rises. Guthrie, Loeb, and Hemingway jousted with one another to gain the attentions of Lady Duff Twysden, who provoked her admirers by flirting with the young matador Ordóñez. One night, she disappeared at a party and turned up the next morning with an unexplained black eye. Guthrie, her fiancé, took to casually goading Loeb about how Twysden now spurned him, while Loeb accepted the insults with a stoic passivity, mooning over Twysden, the others felt like a lovesick puppy. Meanwhile, Richardson, Hemingway's wife, was appalled to observe Hemingway's evident infatuation. On the sixth night, tensions came to a head. Over after-dinner brandies in the plaza beneath exploding fireworks, Hemingway told Loeb that he should go back to Paris. "You've already done enough to spoil this party." Loeb declared that he would only depart if Twysden asked him to. She refused, making Hemingway snarl, "You lousy bastard running to a woman." Loeb challenged the much larger Hemingway to a fight, and the pair went down an alley to punch it out. But as soon as they got there, the tensions diffused. When Loeb took off his spectacles, Hemingway joked that he would hold Loeb's jacket. Loeb offered to hold Hemingway's. They both laughed. Duff, Loeb later wrote, no longer seemed to matter. Hemingway even left Loeb a letter of apology the next morning, saying that he was thoroughly ashamed of his behavior. On the last day of the vacation, when everyone was preparing to leave Pamplona, Twysden and Guthrie declared that they had no money to pay their hotel bill. Stewart lent the pair funds that he knew were as good as gone. The exhausted crew went their separate ways, scattering around Europe. The festivities were over, but their literary afterlives were just beginning. Hemingway left Pamplona with a lousy feeling, he later wrote, but it faded as he and Richardson took the train south in a compartment with a wine salesman who shared his samples. The vacation may have been a fiasco, but it provided him with literary inspiration. In Madrid, he threw himself into writing in the mornings, scribbling furiously by hand on loose leaves of paper, and watching bullfights with Richardson in the afternoon. Hemingway's first book was a cross between a memoir and travel book. But soon he changed his friends' names and fictionalized the situation in particular, altering the narrator's name from Hem to Jake Barnes, a war veteran who was wounded in the groin and made impotent, adding a hopelessness to his infatuation with Lady Brett Ashley, as Twysden was renamed. The free-living, hard-drinking Brett uses wit and jollity to mask her inner desperation. She also runs off to Madrid with the young bullfighter, and after refusing to marry him, has to be rescued broke by Jake. Along the way, the lovelorn Harold Loeb became Robert Cohn, in a harsh and blatantly anti-Semitic characterization that turned Hemingway's once close friend into a figure of derision, one writer has noted, who was a cross between a boob and a bore. Richardson, meanwhile, was written out of the story entirely. Within 8 weeks, Hemingway had completed a draft. His friend F. Scott Fitzgerald helped him edit the manuscript, convincing him that the first rambling two chapters should be cut. The finished novel was published by Scribner's in October 1926. To strong reviews and sales, with Hemingway's terse style appealing to both highbrow literary circles and mainstream readers. The novel was elevated from a gossipy Ramon à Clef to a literary event by an epigraph from Gertrude Stein, who proclaimed that the poorly behaved characters were in fact part of a lost generation, the first usage in print of this now famous term. It's difficult to imagine the book's impact today, when every generation from Beats to Gen Z have felt itself lost. But it gave expression to the existential malaise left by the First World War, which shattered traditional values and left its survivors purposeless. The novel was, biographer Mary Dearborn writes, perhaps the first great novel of disaffected youth. For the real-life characters, it meant the end of friendships. For the rest of his life, Loeb was puzzled as to why his friend Hemingway had betrayed him. Loeb had even helped get some of his early writings in print, and tried to set the record straight in a 1959 memoir, The Way It Was, a 1967 essay, Hemingway's Bitterness. Although Lady Twysden had been reduced to the promiscuous Lady Ashley, an alcoholic nymphomaniac, Hemingway later called her character, she appeared to be more philosophical, telling one mutual friend in Paris, "Of course Hemingway said nasty things, but after all, he was writing a novel. Who cares? Not me." Still, they soon fell out of touch in Paris. Hemingway's marriage to Richardson had also been damaged. His wandering eye soon focused on a mutual friend, the American heiress Pauline Pfeiffer, and the two began an affair. When Hemingway invited both his wife and lover to Pamplona in 1926, the trip was predictably strange, and when he and Richardson returned to Paris by train, they left via different station exits to separate homes. When he returned to the festival in 1927, Hemingway was accompanied by Pfeiffer as his new wife. By then, The Sun Also Rises had put Hemingway on track to become one of the most celebrated American writers of the 20th century, establishing the macho persona he would build on for the rest of his life. Zelda Fitzgerald, for one, thought his bravura a fraud, sniffing that nobody could be as male as all that. Her verdict on The Sun Also Rises was just as caustic. It's just about bullfighting, bullslinging, and bull S. Even so, it consistently appears today on lists of great American novels. Hemingway continued to visit San Fermín throughout his life, although with a long interruption of 22 years thanks to the Spanish Civil War, which he reported on and made the subject of his novel For Whom the Bell Tolls, and the subsequent military dictatorship of Francisco Franco. When he returned in 1953 with his fourth wife, Mary Welsh, he was still not well known among the Spanish public. Sun Also Rises had filtered into the country only through stray copies printed in Argentina, and many regarded it with bemusement. The following year, he won the Nobel Prize in Literature. By his next visit to the festival, in 1959, Hemingway was at the height of his fame, now the bearded bear-like papa, and mobbed by well-wishers, autograph hunters, and journalists from Spain and beyond. As for the San Fermín Festival, it ends as it has for centuries, with thousands of townsfolk gathering before the town hall to sing Pobre de mí, Poor Me, a lament that the 9 days of madness are over, as people leave their bandanas by candles at the nearby church door. The mayor exhorts them to start their countdown for the next year's party. "I don't know how you're going to write a story about San Fermín," Moaning said, when we met for one last drink on the way to the train station. "It has no beginning and no end. You think it's over, but it's not. Once you've been here, you never really leave." Next, we'll move on to an article titled Cards on the Table by John Last. The true history of tarot is as colorful as the hypnotic designs of its decks. Not far from one of Milan's last remaining medieval gates is a tiny shop door, sandwiched between shuttered storefronts. Cross the threshold, and you'll enter a gilded world of esoteric symbols, stars, skeletons, and fools. This is Il Menighello, the workshop of some of Italy's last known great tarot artisans. Inside on the register is a portrait of its original owner, Osvaldo Menegazzi. While tarot may be a game or hobby for many, for Menegazzi it was always first and foremost about the art. Before his death in 2021, he had become world famous for his painstaking hand-painted reproductions of some of the world's most ancient and storied tarot decks. His desk is a mess of paints and materials, is just as he left it. On a rainy day last spring, I met his niece, Christina Dorsini, at the shop. Since Menegazzi's death, Dorsini, an art historian and tarot expert in her own right, has taken over guiding visitors through the masterworks created by her late uncle. Among the stacks surrounding us are three tarots, a cat-themed tarot, a Hebrew tarot, and a tiny Tarocchi di Fumatori, smoker's tarot, wherein a characterization of death can be seen enjoying a curly pipe. Menegazzi published more than 100 such decks, including many of his own invention. Each deck offers us a Lo Scrigno di Sapienza, a treasure trove of wisdom, Dorsini says. What unites these diverse decks is their standard form, generally 78 cards separated into 56 numbered minor arcana, much like the modern numbered playing cards, and 22 trumps, the major arcana, each with a mysterious character. Every card is rich with symbolism, adorned with pentacles, stars, chalices, and wands, bearing names like the world, justice, and temperance, and featuring enigmatic characters like the fool, the lovers, or the hermit. These cards may have started life in 15th century Italy as a sophisticated game, but in the past 500 years they have taken on an entirely different meaning. It's the ambiguity of these figures that has drawn fortune tellers who use combinations of images to open a window into the future. Dorsini, following her uncle, is skeptical of such uses. "We don't do readings," declares a sign near the cash register, a frequent point of contention with visitors to the shop. Like her uncle, Dorsini was first drawn to these cards by their beautiful artistry, and by a historian's desire to understand the origins of their imagery. Tarot was a figurative culture that was born here in Italy, in Milan, she says. But today, the symbology of each card is really difficult for us to understand. In fact, Menegazzi's shop has become famous for his decades-long quest to collect, study, and meticulously reproduce the historic decks that originated many of tarot's most common figures. Some of the old decks, with just a few surviving cards, are extremely rare. In 2021, Menegazzi became the first person to reproduce one such deck in nearly 600 years. A few days after I first held one of Menegazzi's reproductions, I traveled west to Turin, where for a few short minutes I was able to look at the original. In the former stables of an Italian royal palace, I met Federica Pozzi, the director of scientific laboratories at the Center for Conservation and Restoration of Cultural Heritage, La Venaria Reale. Here, a team of 12 scientists works to analyze everything from large-scale paintings to ancient Egyptian sarcophagi, as well as some of the oldest tarot cards in the world, in which they perform material analysis. Upstairs in the conservation lab, the restorer applies paint, removable, to allow for future correction with a tiny brush. Researchers around the world, including Pozzi's team, engage in a kind of historical detective work with these cards. Collaborating with 6 different institutions, the Morgan Library and Museum in New York, the Yale University Library, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the National Gallery of Art, Yale's Institute for the Preservation of Cultural Heritage, and the Art Institute of Chicago, and drawing on other collections in Italy, Pozzi was part of the first team to use advanced imaging techniques, including macro X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy, to discover invisible layers in the tarot cards. Researchers from Yale managed to discern stationers' watermarks to definitively date one of the world's oldest tarot decks to an impressively narrow range between 1437 and 1442. These decks, known collectively as the Visconti Sforza decks, offer the earliest blueprint for modern tarot, incorporating many of the same suits and trumps. Historical documents suggest the oldest of these, the incomplete Visconti de Mezzarone deck, was commissioned as a wedding present for the daughter of Filippo Maria Visconti, then Duke of Milan, and her groom, Francesco Sforza, founder of a powerful family. For many years, historians speculated that a deck as unusually fine as this one may have simply been meant as a piece of art. Yet Pozzi's research has shown that the surviving cards bear signs of regular use, worn edges, lost pigments, separating layers. Her lab has confirmed that several cards are replacements, suggesting that their owners wanted a full deck, and corroborating the idea that these cards were meant for gaming. Some scholars, like the tarot historian Andrea Vitali, argue the figures on the cards were meant to offer a scala mystica, or mystical ladder, instructing wayward gamblers in moral and ethical precepts, or else perhaps satirizing those precepts by allowing fools and lovers to trump popes. All of this evidence suggests that the earliest tarot deck may have been used for little more than a courtly card game, an exquisite plaything for the super rich. And yet, tarot has never been so simple to define, nor its origins clear. In Milan, at Menegazzi's workshop, I've held one of his reproductions of the Sola Busca tarot, the earliest complete tarot deck that survives today, dating to the late 15th century. What had struck me about it was just how unlike the modern tarot it is. In place of the standard major arcana is a series of entirely different and unsettling images, obscure figures from antiquity or famous villains, like the Roman Emperor Nero, reveling in the burning of babies. The occultist Peter Mark Adams called the deck stubbornly and irredeemably odd, writing that even after prolonged study, the deck retains its strangeness. For Adams, that oddness suggests that there is a foundational purpose to these cards other than simple entertainment. After all, tarot emerged during a very specific point in European history, when the wealthy courts of Renaissance Italy were retaining armies of scholars to recover hidden wisdom from ancient texts. In the centuries following the production of Visconti's exquisite deck, tarot's popularity as a game increased, and its production moved to France sometime in the 17th and 18th centuries. There, a new school of artists, thinkers, and card readers began to see tarot as infused with a deep occult significance. It was in this milieu that occult writers first began to experiment with the idea that the cards like these could be a key to greater wisdom. In 1770, Jean-Baptiste Alliette, under the pseudonym Etelier, published the book How to Entertain Yourself with a Deck of Cards, providing one of the world's first guides to cartomancy, that is, fortune-telling with cards, a method still used by many fortune-tellers today. And around the same time, Antoine Cour de Gibelin, a French pastor, under a section of his opus Le Monde Primitif, The Primitive World, published from 1773 to 1782, to rewrite Tarot's origin story and suggest for the first time that these cards were far more than just a game. Have we heard that there still exists today a work of the ancient Egyptians, one of their books that escaped the flames which devoured their superb libraries, and which contains their purest doctrine about interesting objects, everyone would, without a doubt, be eager to know, he wrote. If we added that this book is very widespread in a large part of Europe, that for many centuries it has been in the hands of everyone, the surprise would certainly increase. It was the tarot, Court de Gobelins suggested, that contained such a book. Court de Gobelins' entirely speculative account, which counted Louis XVI among its readers, spurred a European craze for all things ancient and Egyptian, and forever tied the origin myth of tarot with the stereotype of gypsy fortune tellers, whom Gobelins credited with preserving the cards over a millennium and carrying them into Europe. In reality, there is absolutely no evidence for Roma in the origin of tarot cards, or any significant role in their spread, says Egil Asprem, a professor at Stockholm University who studies the role of Roma in the European history of magic. In the mountains just southwest of Bologna, a small stone house is home to the International Tarot Museum, founded by Morena Poltroneri and Ernesto Fazzoli in 2007. Inside, Fazzoli leads me around a narrow space crammed with pieces of tarot art and decks donated from around the world. Even tarot cards. There are tarot pop-up books, tarot embroidery, even tarot cards you can eat and drink. Each one is simultaneously a reinvention and a reference to tarot's past spiritual uses. The seed of the card is universal, Fazzoli says. Each artist has a different goal. Recently, tarot's popularity has been surging again, driven partly by interest in cartomancy on social media platforms like TikTok. Some sellers say their sales have doubled or tripled in periods of strife, including the 2008 financial crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic. Many practitioners are uneasy about such booms. Jessica Lanyadu, an astrologer and tarot reader in San Francisco, says too many think the cards can help micromanage our fate, guiding every little decision through the easy answers. More common annoyance for a long time, tarot devotees might be the irony which some new users approach the cards. People have a way of saying, oh, I'm too smart to take it serious, Lanyadu says. Helen Farley, a researcher who has written about the history of these cards, calls tarot a mirror of the society in which it's being used. Peering into the mirror today, we might see a more atomistic world, with tarot just another product to brand and sell. Yet all around us, tarot is being reinvented. Alight upon the right deck and learn its history, and you might discover a piece of our collective future, too. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kevin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.